I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Innovation has become the new imperative for organizations in every field, and today's guests are major league innovators. Chris Whittle first brought TV news to America's classrooms through Channel One. Then he decided to think bigger and founded Edison Schools. Now he calls for reinventing education in his new book, Crash Course. Tom Kelly heads IDEO, the firm responsible for the design of such products as the Apple Mouse, the Palm 5, and Polaroid's iZone Instant Camera. In his new book, The 10 Faces of Innovation, he explains his firm's strategies for driving creativity throughout organizations. We'll talk about innovation today with Chris Whittle and Tom Kelly on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. He's been accused of thinking big, sometimes too big. His empire has been done, undone, and redone. Chris Whittle was the owner of Esquire magazine and the founder of Whittle Communications and Channel One before founding Edison Schools. This year, Edison Schools will serve more than 330,000 students in 25 states, the District of Columbia, and the United Kingdom. Chris, education is big business in America.
I wouldn't necessarily call it business, but it's definitely a very big world. The United States spends over $400 billion a year on its K-12 schools. We spend almost $400 million per school hour, and there are more people, actually five times as many people, that are employed in public education as are employed in the world's largest company, Walmart.
But estimates are that one-third of students who enter ninth grade never graduate. We're spending a lot of money. We're not getting a lot of results. Why?
Let's start here. We have a lot of terrific schools in the United States, but the problem is we have lots of dreadful public schools. And I think one of the reasons why is that our school model, think of it as the school design, and I don't mean the buildings, but the entire concept of school, is really something that dates back well over 100 years, and it's just out of date, and we need to take that design out of the 19th century and into the 21st century if we're going to really see, A, the kind of achievement we want from kids, and B, for America to remain competitive in the century ahead.
Well, some people would say that schools used to recognize that many children would never go on to higher education. They would simply go to the farms, they would go to the factories, and now we expect everyone to be able to come out of school and go to higher education. So many students fail in school that it seems like we've begun to believe that failure is inevitable. I mean, is it for a certain percentage of students?
I don't think so at all. I think 99% of our children and plus can achieve a basic level of literacy and numeracy in the United States that will guarantee them at least some participation in the American dream. Whether they go on to college or whether they go on to the finest colleges is another thing. But the great majority of children can be literate. And unfortunately, almost one-third of United States children, more children than reside in England, are below basic levels of literacy today. And that's a tragedy that shouldn't exist and that we should not let occur in this country.
Well, why do we tolerate? Why do we tolerate this rate of failure?
One of the reasons is America's rich and America's powerful don't experience this problem. If you're affluent in the United States, you've always had two choices that people of poverty don't have. You could move to a place that did have really fine public schools, or you could choose to send your child to a private school. And as a result, in 1997, the Washington Post did a story in which not one member of Congress, not one member of Senate, not one senior member of the administration sent their children to the D.C. public schools. When America's influential don't experience the problem, what you find is that we're not addressing it, and people of poverty don't have the means to kind of address this issue. And so I think ownership of the problem is a big part of it.
You make a very powerful point that we don't distribute airline safety electricity or auto safety on a curve. Explain how you related that to education.
I think a lot of people do think that some degree of failure is inevitable. That if you stop somebody on the street and you said, you know, do you think it's reasonable that 20 or 30% of children in a school failed? A lot of people would go, yeah, that doesn't sound so terrible. The truth is that's not the way it works, though. We have some schools in the United States, and literally in New York State, There are 13 schools in which every child failed, 100% failure rate. And what that tells us is it's not the children in that case. It's actually their school that is not serving those children. And again, we don't have to look for every child in the United States to be an MIT PhD. That's not what we should be reaching for. We should look for every child to be able to read well and compute well, and that we can achieve.
Unlike almost every industry I can think of, education remains essentially a local enterprise. Chris, is that part of the problem?
This is a very tricky question in the following way. I happen to believe that local monitoring and local control of schools is a good thing. And that's the way our public schools are currently set up, is that they are in 15,000 different school systems right down to the community level. There's a problem with that, though, in that those school systems, even the largest of them, are not big enough to conduct what we see going on in every other sector of American life, which is very significant research and development to advance whatever service or product that particular industry is trying to do. And so what you see is you see almost no investment in the United States in trying to come up with what the next generation of schools look like. And that is a big problem with our schools being completely localized. And we need to come up with solutions that figure out how can we have research and development in a highly fragmented world.
Some would say that universities, particularly universities, departments of education, schools of education, are doing that research. You don't agree?
They are doing some of that research, but it's very interesting you use the word research. And I was actually using the phrase research and development. And you're correct that there is a good bit of research going on, but research is very, very different than development. Development is the operationalizing of what comes out of research. And we have very little of that going on in the United States. And it's where you take an insight and actually build a new school around it and go, let's see if this works. And what you don't see universities doing, because it's not really their role, is actually building the next generations of schools. They may be examining possible things that go into them. If the federal government, would step up and say, we're going to treat educational research and development as seriously as, for instance, we treat healthcare research and development, then you'd see a lot of universities stepping up their roles. But right now, they don't have the funds, and the feds aren't giving them the funds to do that.
Everyone seems to agree that schools need great leaders, good teachers, but they are hard to attract and keep in our education system. Why?
First of all, it's an extremely difficult job. If you come right out of college and you are thrown into a tough urban classroom, it can be very discouraging and very quickly so. And roughly half of all the teachers that begin teaching will quit within 3 years of the time that they begin. So first of all, it's tough to start with. Secondly, America does not reward teachers at anywhere near the level reward any other profession. Average U.S. teacher makes $46,000 a year. And to show you another way, the average principal in the United States makes about $80,000. Compare that principal role to a Walmart store manager who makes pushing $200,000, or a 747 pilot that makes close to $250,000. 747 pilot's got 300 souls on board. A U.S. principal's got 600 souls on board. We're simply not rewarding these fields at the level we should.
You lay out in your book the elements for a better future for public education, and of course you've begun to talk about some of those elements with funding R&D at a much greater level and rethinking the ways in which we reward teachers and principals. Talk about your formula for this better future.
In Crash Course, what I try to do is open the reader's mind that there may be different ways to organize schools than we've ever imagined. And one of the things I tried to do is I said, if we were to try to double teacher pay in the United States, how would we do it? I don't believe we can do it via taxing. I think that we can make some improvements via increasing taxes, but I don't think we can double teacher pay that way because it would cost every household an additional $1,000 a year in taxes. But here's an example of how we might do it. A typical student goes to school 6 hours a day. If we said instead of six classes each day, you're only going to have three. And by the way, I'm speaking of middle and high schools. And so instead of six classes, you have three. And since there are only three classes, we only need half as many teachers, and therefore we're going to pay teachers twice as much. That actually, in an economic sense, could work. Now, the first thing listeners are saying or asking is, but what do students do the other 3 hours a day? And I believe that they could work on their own, and they could work in small student groups. They could work doing research via the internet. They could be reading, and they could be supervised by prefects, meaning older students. I think the graduate student model of college could, in many respects, be imported into our middle and high schools. And that's an example of a different kind of school design that could yield very different rewards for educators and I actually think very good achievement for kids as well.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Chris Whittle. He's founder and CEO of Edison Schools and author of the new book, Crash Course, Imagining a Better Future for Public Education. Chris, have you tried some of these ideas in your own schools, in Edison Schools, the three classes a day, and having children otherwise engaged in working without a teacher?
The answer is no. And I wrote this book. I've been doing public schools now for 15 years. And Edison is, we educate over 60,000 children in over 100 sites around the United States. So we're certainly experienced in this world. I wrote the book really for two reasons. One, to stimulate my own thinking about what we should be doing in the future, but also to share that with other public educators around the United States. Do we plan to do many of the things that I'm talking about in my book? Absolutely, and we are working on those in a variety of ways. Some of these we're already doing, but most of them are on the drawing boards for the future.
Where have you had pushback from your own educators, those inside Edison Schools, saying, Chris, sounds good on paper, but no way?
Actually, on these particular ideas, not a lot of pushback. I think most people, particularly within Edison, because they tend to be a very innovative and forward-thinking group, they see many of these things coming down the road. Outside of Edison's environment, there is pushback. And for example, some people believe that teachers should, in effect, take a vow of poverty when they enter the teaching profession. I don't happen to think that. And I think there are many teachers that do that, and America is in their debt daily for doing that. But I think to expect 3 million teachers, which is the number of teachers we currently have in the U.S., to make economic sacrifices of their own families is not a realistic way to run or manage public schools. And I think if we want terrific teachers in our schools, we're going to have to start rewarding them in a way that they go, I want to do this versus be a lawyer or a doctor or a scientist or whatever.
How much of the resistance to entering education, the education field as a teacher or a school leader, do you think has to do with money, and how much of it do you think has to do with school culture?
It's a good question. I don't think money is the only factor. Example, I think a lot of young teachers come into the field and go, I'm going to do this for 2 or 3 or 4 years. I can afford to do it. They almost think of it as a domestic Peace Corps in some ways, and they don't really care about the money. I think for younger teachers, that may often be the case. And then I think some other teachers do, in fact, go, the culture of the school that they're in, the discipline issues that they often encounter, a feeling that they're not making the progress that they'd like to make does often force them out of it. And so fixing the pay is not enough. We also need to fix the success of our schools, because no teacher wants to be in a school that they think is failing.
As you propose radically altering the pay of principals and teachers, skeptics might argue that their performance is not up to par now, so why pay more for what they perceive as poor performance?
I don't actually blame our poor performance on teachers and principals for the most part. I'm not saying we don't have some poor performing principals and teachers, but I don't think that's what is driving the bulk of school failure in the United States. Most teachers and principals, they don't get up every day going, let's figure out how we can screw up the performance of a school. They get up going, let's go to school and try to do our job as best we can. I think teachers and principals are as much a victim of our old design and old gestalt as students are. and they are suffering from the way we try to do this as much as students.
When you say old design and old gestalt, what exactly are you referring to, Chris?
If you and I went back to our old elementary schools, they may not physically be there anymore, but they are there in virtually every respect. The school day looks a lot like it used to. The way classes are divided up into subjects at an hour per subject, the way the entire school functions, one principal, 20 or 30 teachers, that's what I mean by design. It's the entire construct of the educational program is not substantially changed from what it was 100 years ago. And we need to challenge that. I'll give you an example. If I ask you right now, here's the plan. For the next 13 years, you're going to be in a classroom 6 hours a day in which there's going to be an instructor that's basically either teaching you or watching over you, and you're going to do that for 13 years. You want to sign up for that? Not one adult listening to this would consider that. And if you want to know why lots of our middle and high school students are acting out, we are boring them to tears with this current educational design. And in fact, lots of very good students are dropping out. If you want to see advanced versions of that, Bill Gates, Michael Dell dropping out of college is an example of it, where they went, you know, I can really do something better with my time. And lots of kids are doing the same thing in middle and high school.
Some people would respond to you, I think, Chris, with this notion. So are you telling me teachers need to entertain students? I mean, is it about entertainment? Because they're bored. So, okay, give me your alternative to boring kids to death.
I'll give you an example. A teacher can say, I've got a project here. It's a research project. Or I've got six that you can choose from. And a couple of hours today, I want you working on that on your own. A lot of students would respond very differently to that. Now, you might go, but would they really do it? If we just start cold turkey on it, maybe not. But if we started early on in third grade and fifth grade saying, okay, there's going to be a portion of your time during the day that you're going to be working on your own, I think we could actually train up students to be much more independent. And if you think about it, that's really what we want them to be, is we want them to be independent learners and independent workers in the future, not people that have to be supervised every minute of their day.
Well, it sounds like a lot more fun to me. You mentioned third grade, and in your book, Crash Course, you recommend a third grade diploma. I skipped that earlier, and I want to go back to it because I think that's an important concept. Tell me why you're recommending that third grade diploma.
In the United States, where our educational failure is really happening, we tend to think it's happening in our middle schools and our high schools. It's just not so. It's happening because our youngest students are not coming out as readers. And if we have third grade students that can't read, it is predetermined what is going to happen to them in middle and high schools. They are, a high percentage of those children are not going to make it. Here's an interesting fact. We spend much more money on high school seniors than we do on kindergartners. I would argue we should reverse that. We should be spending far more money at the kindergarten, first, second grade to ensure that our children have the foundations that they need. We should be starting public education earlier in this country and funding it. And then we should be spending less at the high school level because, in fact, if we've done it right in the beginning, we're going to do fine in the future. And what I was suggesting here is that we ought to have a diploma that you get in the third grade, but you don't get it unless you're a terrific reader, and that's the sign that you can go on.
Your book is far more than just a collection of interesting and provocative ideas. I mean, you've laid out what you believe is a comprehensive strategy for changing America's education outcomes. Do you have any hope, Chris, that your blueprint for America's schools can actually gain traction?
Yes. 15 years ago when I got into this, there were no national companies that were actually providers of public schools in the United States. Today there are 42. And what that tells me is things are changing. They're not changing as rapidly as anyone would like to see, but many different things are occurring. The one thing that I think must happen for that change to accelerate is our federal government has got to step up to not being the policeman of public education, not being the controller of public education, but being a force for invention in public education. And we need a NASA of public education at the federal level that is going. We can't expect Peoria or Denver to be in the significant research and development part of this. And we, the federal government, are going to step into that particular lurch. And if they do that, I think you're going to see a lot of change in the 15 or 20 years ahead.
You were actually fired from Edison at one point, but you kept coming to work, and eventually you regained your position as head of the company. Do you think there's a metaphor there for school improvement?
Ask me that. First of all, your facts are correct, but ask me that question again. I don't quite understand it.
Well, I'm just wondering. I mean, there's a certain persistence that you showed, I guess, in continuing to come to work. There's a perseverance and a certain courage, I guess, that eventually meant, you know, you stuck with it and your company moved forward. So I'm curious if you see any lesson there for school improvement.
Now I get the question. I do. We've got to stop looking for the quick fixes in schools. Our schools didn't get in this condition in a couple of years. This took hundreds of years to get the way it is. And we can't look to local superintendents or local heads of state education to go, we want these fixed in 2 or 3 years. I've now been doing this for 15 years. I hope to do it for another 15. And this takes a lot of time and a lot of focus. And we've got to allow that. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a sense of urgency about it. We should, but we've also got to be realistic about how long it takes to correct, you know, some of the issues we're dealing with.
Chris, I've been recommending your book to everyone I know. I think it's terrific. Crash Course, Imagining a Better Future for Public Education. Chris, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Whittle is the author of Crash Course and founder of Edison Schools. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about what cities are doing today to find new school superintendents. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Tom Kelly about his new book, The 10 Faces of Innovation. You're listening to Smart City. Otis, some people think the toughest management job in American cities today is school superintendent, and I don't think I can disagree.
No, it's really a tough, tough job. Turns out the average tenure of school superintendents in many places is only about 3 to 5 years, and some of them are much shorter than that. A couple of reasons for it, I guess. Public schools are pretty troubled institutions these days, particularly in big cities, but even in the suburbs, there's a lot of pressure on these people. The No Child Left Behind law has really been turning up a lot of problems in the school system. Some would argue it's also creating some problems in the school systems, but it certainly is because of all the statistics, making it clear where the school systems are falling down. You have the usual problems with the teachers' unions, and in some places these unions can be very, very tough, and with all the pressure to change from No Child Left Behind, the unions are resisting a lot of those changes. So that puts the superintendents in a really tough management position. And finally, they have to deal with school boards, which are becoming more and more politicized. Where used to school boards were made up of sort of long-time civic volunteers, increasingly they're being used as sort of single-issue advocates and people who want to run for other political office, and they see that as a great way to make a name for themselves. So the nature of the job of school superintendent has changed dramatically, got much, much, much more political, and the management demands are just tremendous.
Is there any urban school system in America considered to be succeeding?
Well, we thought Houston was, and then we found out that perhaps
books
they really
cooked.
Weren't. So it's hard to tell. We're just getting into the era in which we can begin to track these performances accurately using standard data, and that comes from the No Child Left Behind law. And again, it's very criticized. I understand that, but it is truly shining a light on what's going on within the school system. So we don't know. What we do know is that the nature of the people running for or seeking these jobs has changed. I find it fascinating that former Governor Roy Romer, former governor of Colorado, is now the school superintendent of Los Angeles. So it took a master politician to go into a place like L.A. and figure out how to make things work there. And even there, I have to say, he's constantly in hot water. Mm-hmm. Tougher job than being governor.
I was looking at Atlanta employment figures the other day, and of course Atlanta is a great balanced economy, and you think of it as a real corporate center, and yet the largest single employer at Metro Atlanta is the Gwinnett County School System.
Yeah, They're huge operations. As one of the superintendents pointed out to me recently, they're one of the largest transportation providers in the region and one of the largest food operations in the region. So they're very complicated, very large organizations. Takes remarkable people to run them.
It's a job I wouldn't want.
Me either.
We'll talk to you next week. Thanks,
okay.
Otis.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Tom Kelly is the general manager of IDEO, the design and development firm known for its creation of award-winning innovative products, including the Apple Mouse, the Palm 5, and Polaroid's iZone instant camera. He's author of the best-selling business classic, The Art of Innovation. He works with business leaders on how to use innovation to transform a business's culture and strategic thinking. His latest book is The 10 Faces of Innovation. Tom, how do you define innovation?
Innovation is really the combination of a new idea and then deriving value from it. So there's plenty of inventions out there, weird little things that nobody actually really wants. But innovation is the idea then implemented in a way that brings value to people, either profit to a corporation or value to society or an organization.
And where does innovation in organizations come from?
I think one of the key things is ultimately innovation is a group activity in organizations. I think especially in America we cling to this idea of the lone genius. But in fact, I think almost everything worth doing inside of organizations, any form of innovation, really is a group effort. And so the best of the innovations of the last few decades have come out of groups.
And Tom, in terms of groups functioning around this idea or this goal of innovation, is it more a consensus process? Is it a process filled with friction? How does the group have to function in order to produce innovation?
I don't think it's really consensus-driven because in the innovation process, it's kind of messy. In fact, there is this part of the process that some people call creative abrasion, in which people with strong wills and lots of ideas actually kind of rub against each other, and sometimes there's conflict, but there's conflict with a purpose. Everybody wants the same kind of end results. People have different ways or ideas about how to go about that, but as long as you agree that you're aiming for the same end result, then I think a lot of good things can still happen.
How is innovation in organizations encouraged and brought forth?
I think that question really gets at the idea of barriers to innovation. And a lot of organizations have these kind of rules or structures or inhibitions that keep people kind of in their box. They've got an idea, but they're kind of afraid to bring it out because one reason might be they think people will laugh at them. And a culture in which people ridicule you for an idea that's a little outside the ordinary, I would say that would be an example of a barrier to innovation.
Well, and of course, we know that as devil's advocate, you talked about devil's advocates in your book, and as you put it, they are idea wreckers. What happens when someone, and we've all experienced this, what happens when someone plays devil's advocate with an idea? There's almost a compulsion for someone to play that role, isn't it?
Sure. We've all been in those meetings where an idea on the table, maybe it's our idea, is being discussed and seems to be kind of going favorably, and maybe you're building a little momentum around it, and then one person will say, hey, let me play devil's advocate for a minute. And especially if you're the person that's been pushing that idea forward, you feel like all the air has just been sucked out of the room. Right, you know that you're about to be criticized, probably in a kind of a severe way, and the person's going to expect you later to not take it personally, right? That's not them talking, that's the devil's advocate. It's kind of like the devil made me do it, right? But the net effect is the devil's advocate is almost always arguing against a new idea. And they're very seldom proposing a new idea of their own. They're just saying, oh, let's not change. Let's defend the status quo. Let's shoot down this new idea that's on the table.
So your idea for 10 Faces of Innovation in some ways is a replacement for the devil's advocate, or at least an offset to it. Because if someone at the table is going to play devil's advocate, then you're suggesting people at the table need to deliberately play other roles.
Right. If the devil's advocate is not going to go away, all I really want is to create a team of people who can stand up to him, right, and say, okay, you've got your point of view, you want to be the devil's advocate, you want to defend the status quo, but listen, let me be anthropologist for a minute, because I have been watching our customers for years, and I think this is a problem that they have that we could solve for them. Or let me be the experimenter for a minute, and because I can test out this idea. I think it's a good idea. You think it's a bad idea. In 1 week, I can test it out if I do the right experiment, right? So you field a team of people like that who will stand up to the devil's advocate, propose alternative points of view, and hopefully get the devil's advocate to sit back down, put him back in his place.
Now, a couple of questions. If I am playing what you call the role of anthropologist in one meeting, is that my designated role in the organization? Should I always play that role?
No, I'm really glad you asked this question, because as I talk about the 10 phases of innovation, some people do jump to the conclusion that I'm talking about their inherent underlying personality. And there are some structures like that. There's something called Myers-Briggs. There's something called the Enneagram. And those are about your true underlying personality, whereas the 10 phases of innovation are really about roles or personas that you can take on as appropriate to push innovation forward. You can then release one role and you can switch into another role.
You mentioned anthropologist. You mentioned experimenter. Tell me about some of the other 10 faces of innovation.
The faces really fall into three categories. There's the learning roles, the ones you described, the anthropologist, the experimenter. There's also one called the cross-pollinator, who travels across many industries, travels across many cultures or geography, and brings new ideas back home and translates them for use in their own organization. So those are the learning roles, but there's also organizing roles who are really good at working the organization to get things done, to get their ideas pushed forward and implemented. And then there are what I call the building roles, which are about creating new things. So, for example, in the building roles, there's one called the experience architect, who creates great experiences for customers or for constituents of the organization.
Tom, I'm curious. This is really off the point a little bit, but you're not only a great innovator, but you're clearly a great leader of teams and a wonderful communicator. And I'm just curious, you have 10 faces. Probably none of us can remember 10 things. We're not, you know, that's the 7-digit phone number idea. And so you've then collected these 10 faces under three broad categories. Is that so people can remember them?
I really view the 10 as more like a menu than a collection you've got to keep in your head all at one time. You refer to that thing called the magic number 7 plus or minus 2. The brain can't really hold 10 things in at once. So I'm not suggesting that people try to think about all 10 all at once and say, okay, which one am I going to be right now? It's more like you've kind of got a deck of cards, and you go through the cards and say, hey, would the anthropologist help at this point? Because I'm kind of good at the anthropologist role. Let me switch into that role for a moment and propose that we go out in the field and watch human behavior. Or you go through the deck a little more and you say, gee, here's the collaborator card. You know, if I collaborate with another company, another group within my company, another team that's already working on a similar thing, gee, maybe I can build up some new momentum. So it's really like going through options rather than holding all 10 in your brain. Because as you suggest, holding all 10, I have trouble remembering all 10 sometimes.
It may not be a coincidence that you use the analogy of a deck of cards, because you actually at IDEO produced a deck of cards, didn't you, to help people think about innovation.
We developed these methodologies that were mostly related to the anthropologists, by the way. We developed dozens of them, but a couple of years back, somebody codified them into these 51 cards that we created in this card deck. The 52nd card in the deck is blank so that you can create your own, because it really is open-ended. We're not saying that there are only 51 ideas. We're saying these are the 51 we picked. And you use them very much as I just described, because, of course, no one can remember the 51, right? But you say, okay, in this situation, I am stuck on a problem. I have something that I want to create new, or I want to develop some new learning. Which of the 51 cards will I use? And they're quite useful for that. And that's really why we created them as a card deck rather than as a book, because the essential usage pattern is to sort through them, as opposed to a book which you read in a kind of a linear way.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Tom Kelly. He's the general manager of IDEO, and author of the new book, The 10 Faces of Innovation. thinking about these 10 roles, if I'm a leader in an organization, I want to cultivate these personas among my people so that we can fire up innovation, if you will, and sort of overcome the natural skepticism that accompanies any suggestions for change. So as a leader, what should I do in terms of introducing the concept, identifying people to fill the roles, and then cultivating people in those roles, even though they may, as you say, change from time to time?
As a leader, I think the opportunity that you can offer people is to kind of broaden their palate a little bit, because there's plenty of people out there leading these lives of quiet desperation where they're confined by circumstances or by the title on their business card or by their job description, and they kind of get in a rut and they start to believe that they're not allowed to change their behavior beyond where they currently are. And I think a part of the idea here is that a leader can look at these 10 phases of innovation and say, gee, Joanne, you have a little bit of the anthropologist in you. Maybe we could nurture that a little bit, because if you got good at that, you'd be a more valuable person on the team, and you yourself might feel a little more self-actualized. It might be fun for you. It might be creative. And so as far as what you look for example, the cross-pollinator is somebody who's equal parts student and teacher. It's not enough to just go on a trip to Europe, say, or India. It's not enough to go there and have an interesting time and learn a lot yourself. You're not a cross-pollinator in that mode. In order to be the cross-pollinator, you have to first be the student and have that learning, but then be the teacher and share that learning with your friends and colleagues when you come back home. So not just kind of reportage about here's what I saw, here's what I did, but here's what I learned. And specifically, here's what I learned that might be applicable to our organization. And so you can encourage somebody who's already good at learning to take on a little more of a teaching role. Next thing you know, you've got a cross-pollinator.
Is this another way, Tom, to think about diversity in your organization?
I think it's a kind of a layer of diversity that goes on top of the existing definition of disciplines. So you've got this organization chart that says, okay, you've got the marketing department, you've got the engineering department, you've got the finance department. But if you can offer these new 10 faces, these new innovation roles, I can be the systems analyst in IT with a kind of streak of the storyteller. And so for me, as an individual contributor in the organization, gee, I can kind of enrich my life. I can add new energy to this job that I've had for a long time by taking on this new role.
Now, you, of course, run a firm, IDEO, that is deeply involved in producing innovative products and experiences for your client and your clients and their customers. Do you hire for these roles, or as a leader of IDEO, again, where your central job is innovation, do you look for people with these kinds of natural inclinations, or how do you use this sort of thinking in your own organization?
We are implicitly hiring for these roles. We don't have it on a sheet of paper like I'm looking for a collaborator for this position. But what we are specifically looking for is this thing we call a T-shaped person. So a T-shaped person is somebody who's got their field of expertise. They've got deep expertise in some area, but that's the vertical part of the T. But on the horizontal part of the T, and this is where the multiple faces come in, we're looking for people who have an understanding of and an appreciation for the other roles as well. So we like people with some empathy or some appreciation for the other roles, because otherwise, in what we would call an I-shaped person, and we've met people like this, you might have an engineer who's a brilliantly technical person but doesn't, in their own words, suffer fools gladly, which is to say they have no appreciation for the people in marketing, the people in design, the people in finance. We have discovered at IDEO we don't have much room in our organization for that I-shaped person that wants to stick strictly to one narrow definition of their expertise.
What's the most recent product that's come out of IDEO that excites you?
We're working on a new form of digital books. Right now, digital books come in two forms. There's the kind that you play, so it's either a CD or a tape. So that has a physical presence, and then there's the pure downloadable one, right, that you can download onto, say, your Apple iPod. We've got a client called Findaway that has created this product called Playaway, which is a little tiny digital book. It is a physical thing that you could buy, say, in the airport on your way somewhere, and it sells with headphones, and it plays the whole book. It's quite an interesting little positioning in between two existing technologies, kind of in the way Netflix, the DVD they mail you in the mail, is between the things you rent at the video store and the downloadable movies that we know are on the way.
So tell me, Tom, about the team that is developing this product, which, by the way, sounds wonderful to me. So I hope you get it out soon. But tell me about the team, the range of disciplines that were required to get to this product.
To piece the whole product together, there's a lot of elements. So there's the physical characteristics of the machine. And so, you know, there's where we always have anthropologists on the team. So what are people expecting of the book? Because we know no one's going to read the user's manual. And so it's got to be really simple, because here's a product new to the world. So you first have to communicate with the packaging. Well, what is it? You know, it looks like a big pack of matches. So you've got to first tell that story. And then once they buy one, now they're the first-time user. And so you've got to be really careful to make sure that they understand how to use it. And so that's partly the kind of anthropologist mode. And then in the experimenter mode, we developed a lot of quick prototypes of how the thing was going to go together and things like that. And a lot of that prototyping now, which used to be done in our machine shop in California, some of that happens now in Shanghai, where we have a presence. And so you need the experimenter to kind of run through a bunch of rounds of things. And then the role of the director in this case is all about deciding when to stop experimenting, when to stop doing the anthropology, because it's a very cost-driven business. And so we want to be as efficient as we can about going through the process. Because, by the way, if you're the experimenter, you want to keep doing experiments, right? You believe in experimentation. And it's the role of the director to say, okay, I know you can make it better, but we're going to sell this one. We're going to go to market with this one, and those improvements that you have in mind, maybe we'll do those in release 2.0.
How pervasive, Tom, is the innovation process in organizations that are hitting on all innovation cylinders? What percent of people would be involved?
I think in the best organizations, they've got the attention of everybody. You know, from the CEO down, where they say, look, we are going to continuously reinvent ourselves. And once you get a mandate like that, then everybody's at least thinking about it. And some people are saying, gee, I don't know if I can help or not. But if you've got everybody at least thinking about it, you can really push the organization forward. And so we've watched, for example, the new CEO at Procter & Gamble, a guy named A.G. Laffley, who said, look, we're very strong, but we're going to try to get stronger. And so one of the things he said is, I want 50% of our ideas to be brought in from the outside. So it's the opposite of the non-invented here syndrome. And they have some billion-dollar products as a result of taking that approach. And, oh, by the way, the stock price has doubled since he joined the organization.
Yeah, I heard a presentation from Larry Houston last week on that and the way they've insourced ideas. It was pretty exciting. Tell me, one of your faces is the set designer, and you spend some time in the book talking about the characteristics of places that encourage innovation. And I want you to talk to me about that, but sort of blow it up a little bit and think about it in terms of communities. If you could generalize those ideas to the broader community, what do you think would be the characteristics of communities that encourage innovation?
Well, the premise in the book is about how physical space can change people's behavior in that space. If you redesign your office space, you can get people to behave a little different, communicate more, have a freer flow of ideas and things like that. And we've seen some evidence of that at work. And so you're asking to kind of extrapolate that on a kind of an urban scale.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can say is that there's certainly some places you go that seem to encourage certain kinds of behavior, you know, kind of more mingling and things like that. One of my favorite urban spaces, or new urban spaces in America, is that Crown Fountain in Chicago. And I don't know if you've been there, but maybe it was just the day I was there, because I've only been there once. But it's this really fascinating fountain. It must be 40 feet high on both sides. There are faces projected on the wall, and the tight close-ups of Chicago residents, and they change change their face about once a minute, and then eventually they kind of purse their lips, and a stream of water comes shooting out of their lips in this kind of fountain behavior. And so there's these two towers at both sides doing that, and somehow it has turned into this sort of playland for the local kids. And I swear the day, it was a hot summer day I was there, 300 kids were in that fountain just laughing and splashing. And I didn't even have my kids with me, but I just sat and watched these kids for about 20 minutes because it was just so much fun. So there's something where something about the space, one, first said it was okay to act that way. You know, no fence, very welcoming, very friendly with these big faces. And then once the first kid started doing, then seemed like every kid in town was going to show up at that fountain sooner or later.
We have only a minute left, but tell me, where do you find the richest unmined vein of innovation in, or potential innovation in, organizations?
You know, I encourage people to play the cross-pollinator and go somewhere outside their company, right? So in a different industry, or go to another country even. Go to Korea and look at how people buy things with cell phones. You know, go to Helsinki, Finland, and see how they use technology in different ways. And so if you look around, you'll see very kind of foreign ideas that you can translate for use inside of your organization.
Tom, it's another important book, The 10 Faces of Innovation by Tom Kelly. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Tom Kelly's latest book is The 10 Faces of Innovation. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says the scientific method has its place in society, but when it collides with the arts and faith, it creates misunderstanding.
I learned the scientific method in graduate school. I wasn't there to become a scientist. At least not the sort of scientist I had grown up watching on sci-fi movies and wildlife shows. But once I grasped the fundamentals of the scientific method, I realized that being a scientist has little to do with smoky test tubes or African safaris. I enrolled in graduate school after a year in law school with the intention of going back, but my introduction to the scientific method sent me off in another direction. So I pursued a doctorate in communications research, then headed out into the world of business. I always find this a strange story to tell, but I had been an undergraduate in search of a credo, and I found it in my graduate class on research fundamentals. There's nothing arcane about the scientific method. It's just a set of logical, common sense rules for figuring out what's believable. The basic idea is that beliefs or theories must be testable. If you can't test an idea, then believing it is a matter of faith or taste, not science. By faith, I mean anything that we choose to believe on some basis other than the evidence available to our senses and instruments. A theory is tested by the predictions it makes. If a theory's predictions prove incorrect, then that theory is falsified because evidence to the contrary has been observed. If a theory's predictions prove correct, then that theory has proven to be useful and can be relied upon to some extent. But in science, no theory can be proven conclusively because there is always the possibility of undiscovered evidence to the contrary. When scientists characterize their work as contingent or incomplete or in need of further testing, they don't mean that it is speculative or uncertain. They're just describing how the scientific method works. This is why scientists are inherently cautious and skeptical. The scientific method keeps them honest. But prudence notwithstanding, many theories prove so robust under repeated testing that for all practical purposes they can be regarded, informally at least, as established fact. Just because the scientific method never proves anything with complete certainty doesn't mean that other types of explanations are on equal footing with scientific theories. When science collides with the arts and faith, it's usually nothing more than an honest misunderstanding about the approach best suited for the subject under consideration. Scientists study observable phenomena for which testable predictions can be made. That's what science does. But that's all that science does. That's a lot, more than many of us like to admit, quite frankly, but there remain things beyond the scope of the scientific method. We just have to know how to properly and smartly draw the boundaries. Yet time and again, we make this a lot harder to do than it should be. My faith in the scientific method is that within its limits, it will produce the best possible answer. and that beyond those limits, another approach is better. The scientific method lays claim to no more than that, but that is where the scientific method should always prevail. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.